Section 15. The pure contralto sings in the organ loft. The carpenter dresses his plank. The tongue of his foreplane whistles its wild ascending lisp. The married and unmarried children ride home to their Thanksgiving dinner. The pilot seizes the kingpin. He heaves down with a strong arm. The mate stands braced in the whaleboat. Lance and harpoon are ready. The duck shooter walks by silent and cautious stretches. The deacons are ordained with crossed hands at the altar. The spinning girl retreats and advances to the hum of the big wheel. The farmer stops by the bars as he walks on a first day loaf and looks at the oats and rye. The lunatic is carried at last to the asylum, a confirmed case. He will never sleep any more as he did in the cot in his mother's bedroom.
Things are beginning to start. Things are beginning to change. The poem begins with a distinct scene, the pure contralto singing in the organ loft. A contralto is the lowest female voice or voice part, intermediate between soprano and tenor. The contralto is also described as a rare voice because it typically refers to a specific combination of range, color, and tessitura beyond other general voice types. Think of the voices of Cher, Toni Braxton, and Sade. To emphasize the rarity of this voice, this contralto, the speaker describes it as pure. One can imagine the voice, pristine, as it reverberates from the organ loft, reaching the far ends of what we can presume to be a cathedral. As I mentioned initially, things are beginning to start, and the pure contralto marks this start. Imagine the sound waves as they resound further away from the loft, reaching the far ends of the cathedral. Now humor me in imagining that this voice echoes faintly out of the cathedral and into the next scene of the carpenter dressing his plank with the tongue of his foreplane whistling its wild ascending lisp. Interesting how we've transitioned from the pure voice of the contralto to the voice of the carpenter's personified foreplane. So this foreplane whistles its wild ascending lisp. An imaginative way of describing what a foreplane does, which is preparing and flattening rough work pieces before the workpiece is tended to by other planes. In this case, the carpenter uses it to dress a plank. This is again another start. The next lines introduce what I will refer to as Whitman's catalogue. In sections past and the ones we're currently analyzing, you can easily pick up Whitman's style of listing things, people, animals, and scenarios, which hardly have any direct ties to each other. One analysis of this phenomenon reads, "This reviewer went on to compare long sections of Whitman's poetry to an actual auctioneer's catalogue. Even Whitman's admirer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, once commented that Whitman's catalogue style of poetry is easy and leads nowhere. And I partially agree with his sentiment. We certainly know at this point that Song of Myself is a celebration of everything, creation inanimate and animate. It's no surprise that Whitman's lists are so extensive. To say that they're easy and lead nowhere is a valid observation, but I think the lists are within the theme of celebrating everything. Whitman doesn't want to miss a thing, and it shows how deeply observant he is. I also don't think he randomly compiled this list of things and happenings, and I'll justify that later on." The catalogue begins with the married and unmarried children riding home to begin their Thanksgiving dinner, the pilot seizing the kingpin. He heaves down with a strong arm. The mate stands braced in the whaleboat, lance and harpoon are ready to catch a whale. The duck shooter walks by silent and cautious stretches as he prepares to take his shots. The deacons are ordained with crossed hands at the altar, marking the beginning of their tenure. The spinning girl retreats and advances to the hum of the big wheel, a dancer presumably about to start the next part of her performance. The farmer stops by the bars as he walks on his first day loaf and looks at the oats and rye, perhaps at the start of the harvesting season. Then we end with the lunatic, who is carried at last to the asylum a confirmed case. He will never sleep any more as he did in the cot in his mother's bedroom. What a somber ending. At last, the lunatic is carried to the asylum, having been a confirmed case. Following his entrance, his start in this new environment, he will never sleep any more as he did in the cot, in the haven that is his mother's bedroom. I think the phrasing, at last, ties these scenes together. While the pilot and the kingpin, the children at Thanksgiving, the ordained deacons, the duck shooter, and the mate with the lance and harpoon seemingly exist exclusively, their stories all meander to the scene of the lunatic who is at last carried to the asylum. This marks a break in the normalcy we can sense in the lines prior. Everyone and everything is in their place until we have the confirmed lunatic who is stripped from his normalcy and begins a new way in the asylum. So, things are beginning to start, and at the end, things are beginning to change.
The juror printer with grey head and gaunt jaws works at his case. He turns his quid of tobacco while his eyes blur with the manuscript. The malformed limbs are tied to the surgeon's table. What is removed drops horribly in a pail. The quadroon girl is sold at the auction stand. The drunkard nods by the barroom stove. The machinist rolls up his sleeves. The policeman travels his beat. The gatekeeper marks who pass. The young fellow drives the express wagon. I love him, though I do not know him. The half-breed straps on his light boots to compete in the race. The western turkey shooting draws old and young. Some lean on their rifles, some sit on logs. Out from the crowd steps the marksman, takes his position, levels his piece. The groups of newly come immigrants cover the wharf or levee. As the woolly pates hoe in the sugar field, the overseer views them from his saddle.
In this part, we begin with the jaw printer. So the jaw printer is a shortened form of journeyman printer, which refers to both a man's profession and his status within his trade or company. So the jaw printer is old, as evidenced by his grey head and gaunt jaws. Whitman illustrates him turning his quid of tobacco, while his eyes blur with the manuscript. So when a person uses a quid of tobacco, or betel quid, they tuck a pinch of the mixture in between their cheek and gum, where it remains for an extended time. The user then sucks and chews the product and spits it out. So you can tell that the jaw printer is trying to hone in his focus as he turns his quid and blurs his eyes. Whitman then observes a surgeon tending to malformed limbs. I presume that the contents dropping into the pail are blood. The surgeon is in fact performing bloodletting, which was a practice popularly done in the 19th century around the time this poem was written. Next, Whitman talks about the quadroon girl. And I was very fascinated by the concept of the quadroon girl as it relates to the general themes within this section, and that is of race, people and their occupation, and hierarchy within race and occupation. So a quadroon is a person who is one quarter black by descent. So in the colonial societies of the Americas and Australia, a quadroon or quarteron was a person with one quarter African or Aboriginal and three quarters European ancestry. Similar classifications were octoroon for 1/8 black and quinteroon for 1/16 black. The term is rightly offensive and dated, but I find it quite interesting how exhaustive racial categorizations could go, all for the sake of discrimination and further, and to keep some stronghold of purity. Interestingly, I also couldn't find the inverse for an octoroon or a quadroon. Whitman then observes the machinist, the policeman, and the gatekeeper. Again, people going about their day's work. He then talks about the young fellow who drives the express wagon. He loves him, even though he does not know him. And I was intrigued by this line because it took me back to section 13, where Whitman spoke of the young black man that drives the long dray of the stone yard. Steady and tall, he stands poised on one leg on the string piece. His blue shirt exposes his ample neck and breast and loosens over his hip band. His glance is calm and commanding. He tosses the slouch of his hat away from his forehead. The sun falls on his crispy hair and moustache, falls on the black of his polished and perfect limbs. I behold the picturesque giant and love him, and I do not stop there. I'd like to believe that the young fellow who drives the express wagon is in fact the young black man who drives the long dray, and the speaker is readdressing the love he had for him in section 13 once again in section 15. In the next line, the speaker observes the half-breed that straps on his light boots to compete in the race. I found the mention of the fact that the horse competing is a half-breed to be interesting because it definitely coincides with the talk of quadroons and general racial composition, but it could also just be the usual jargon among horse riders. I'm sure within horse racing there are certain characteristics that are beneficial to have for a more highly athletic horse, whereas the racial categorizations are more superficial. In the next lines, the speaker observes a turkey shooting event which draws the old and young. Some lean on their rifles while some sit on logs. Out from the crowd steps the marksman. He takes his position, levels his piece. I found it significant that there was a semicolon after the marksman levels his piece. Thereafter, in the next lines, the speaker talks about the groups of newly come immigrants covering the levee or embankment. After the line of the newly come immigrants on the embankment, the speaker observes the woolly pates as they hoe in the sugar field. The overseer views them from his saddle. A pate is a head. So in describing the heads as woolly, the speaker is describing the hair texture on those heads, which we can definitely presume are the heads of black slaves. I'm thinking of the term nappy hair, which was very much a pejorative, but has since been reclaimed. Nappy in reference to the texture of crude cotton, which was grown and picked by slaves on plantations. I also find a very discreet parallel here. We have the turkey shooters, and in the context of Whitman's time, they were likely white, and out of them, the marksman levels his piece, his shotgun, which introduces the scene of the newly come immigrants on the embankment. Now I relate that to the black slaves hoeing in the sugar field, overseen by a white authority. Could it be that the newly come immigrants are a depiction of newly arrived slaves from the West Indies or ships fresh from West Africa? Who then transition to be the woolly pates in the sugar field? But that's just my guess. But once again, we can see the themes of race and people in their occupation and just hierarchies within those classifications.
The bugle calls in the ballroom. The gentlemen run for their partners. The dancers bow to each other. The youth lies awake in the cedar-roofed garret and harks to the musical rain. The wolverine sets traps on the creek that helps fill the Huron. The squaw, wrapped in her yellow-hemmed cloth, is offering moccasins and bead bags for sale. The connoisseur peers along the exhibition gallery with half-shut eyes bent sideways. As the deckhands make fast the steamboat, the plank is thrown for the shore-going passengers. The young sister holds out the skein while the elder sister winds it off in a ball and stops now and then for the knots. The one-year wife is recovering and happy, having a week ago borne her first child. The clean-haired Yankee girl works with her sewing machine, or in the factory, or mill. The paving man leans on his two-handed rammer. The reporter's lead flies swiftly over the notebook. The sign painter is lettering with blue and gold. The canal boy trots on the towpath. The bookkeeper counts at his desk. The shoemaker waxes his thread. The conductor beats time for the band, and all the performers follow him. The child is baptized. The convert is making his first professions. The regatta is spread on the bay. The race is begun. How the white sails sparkle! The drover, watching his drove, sings out to them that would stray. The peddler sweats with his pack on his back, the purchaser higgling about the odd scent. The bride unrumples her white dress. The minute hand of the clock moves slowly. The opium eater reclines with rigid head and just opened lips. The prostitute draggles her shawl. Her bonnet bobs on her tipsy and pimpled neck. The crowd laugh at her blagged oaths. The men jeer and wink to each other. Miserable, I do not laugh at your oaths, nor jeer you.
We begin this scene with the bugle that calls in the ballroom. The gentlemen run for their partners. Then we move over to the youth that lies awake in the cedar-roofed garret, harking to the musical rain. I wonder if these two scenes are related. While the dancers dance in the ballroom, you have the lonely youth in the garret or attic listening to the musical rain. Is it the shower of music or the rain falling in a melodious manner? If it's the latter, then the scenes aren't related, and so you have this scene of the youth lying awake, listening intently as the rain pours. In the next line, the speaker observes a wolverine, which sets traps on a creek, which helps to fill up a Huron, which is a body of water. I found this scene to be quite random because it has nothing to do with the line prior or the one to follow. The next line, Whitman talks about a squaw wrapped in her yellow-hemmed cloth. The term squaw is a dated term for a North American Indian woman or wife, and I was wondering if he perhaps meant it endearingly. In searching up what the word meant, especially in the early 20th century, there were various films. One that caught my attention was The White Squaw, a film made in 1956. And up until 1877, the term was considered neutral. The next line, the speaker observes the connoisseur as they peer through the exhibition gallery with half-shut eyes bent sideways. I thought this observation to either be two things, either a subtle jab at elitism, or just an observation of how the connoisseur pays attention to the detail of the art, with their eyes half shut, bent sideways. In the lines to follow, the speaker does as they've been doing, observing people, things, occupations, animals. In one instance, he observes a younger sister holding out a skein of wool for the other sister. A homely scene. In the next line, he describes a new mother as she recovers following her time in labor. Regarding work-related things, he observes a reporter, a bookkeeper, a shoemaker. Culturally, he illustrates a conductor who beats time for the band, and then a child who was baptized. Adjacent to that, a convert making their first professions. He transitions from the scene of the regatta spread on the bay, which is a yacht race, and then moves over to the drover who sings out to cattle or sheep, which could act as both a pastoral scene and a religious scene. Then he describes a scene of a peddler. The peddler sweats with his pack on his back, the purchaser higgling about the odd cent. Here, a bargain, an everyday bargain, is taking place. Then the bride unrumples her white dress. The minute hand of the clock moves slowly, denoting the anxiety associated with what is presumed to be the biggest day of her life. From the nervous bride, the speaker observes the opium eater, who reclines with rigid head and just opened lips. I find the phrase rigid head to be interesting. Is it a sign of the addiction or dependency? Then the speaker describes the scene of the prostitute who draggles her shawl. Her bonnet bobs on her tipsy and pimpled neck. I thought the pimpled neck denoted STIs of some sort. The crowd laugh at her blackguard oaths. The men jeer and wink to each other. Miserable, the speaker says, I do not laugh at your oaths, nor jeer you. So the crowd laugh at her blackguard oaths. Blackguard, which describes a man who behaves in a dishonorable way, but also means abuse or disparaging someone. So I wonder if it could be both. The crowd laughs at the men, at the dishonorable men that have employed her services, or the crowd laugh at what she does for a living. But this also takes me back to the scene in section 8, where Whitman sees all the hurt and sorrow in the city, but pays it no mind. Here he doesn't necessarily ignore it, but he refuses to laugh at the oaths, whether it is the woman's oaths or the men who are jeering at her. But all in all, he finds the scene miserable and refuses to partake in it.
The president, holding a cabinet council, is surrounded by the great secretaries. On the piazza walk three matrons, stately and friendly, with twined arms. The crew of the fish smack pack repeated layers of halibut in the hold. The Missourian crosses the plains, toting his wares and his cattle. As the fare collector goes through the train, he gives notice by the jingling of loose change. The floormen are laying the floor, the tinners are tinning the roof, the masons are calling for mortar. In single file, each shouldering his hod, pass onward the labourers. Seasons pursuing each other, the indescribable crowd is gathered. It is the 4th of the 7th month. What salutes of cannon and small arms! Seasons pursuing each other, the plough ploughs, the mower mows, and the winter grain falls in the ground. Off on the lakes, the pike fisher watches and waits by the hole in the frozen surface. The stumps stand thick round the clearing. The squatter strikes deep with his axe. Flatboatmen make fast towards dusk near the cottonwood or pecan trees. Coon seekers go through the regions of the Red River, or through those drained by the Tennessee, or through those of the Arkansas. Torches shine in the dark that hangs on the Chattahoochee or Altamaha. Patriarchs sit at supper with sons and grandsons and great-grandsons around them. In walls of adobe, in canvas tents, rest hunters and trappers after their day's sport. The city sleeps, and the country sleeps. The living sleep for their time, the dead sleep for their time. The old husband sleeps by his wife, and the young husband sleeps by his wife. And these tend inward to me, and I tend outward to them. And such as it is to be of these, more or less I am, and of these, one and all, I weave the song of myself.
It's sort of like we've done an ascension throughout these social hierarchies presented in this poem. We ended that previous section with the observation of the prostitute and the men that were jeering her. Then we are presented with the scene of the president with his cabinet council surrounded by the great secretaries. Continuing on that note, the speaker observes the piazza walk where three matrons dressed stately walk together with twined arms, a look into more privileged and happier lives. And from this jovial attitude, Whitman then observes the crew of the fish smack as they pack repeated layers of halibut in the hold. And so we revert back to the working men, for lines continuing up to the scene where the speaker observes a 4th of July celebration. He says, "Seasons pursuing each other, the indescribable crowd is gathered. It is the 4th of the 7th month. What salutes of cannon and small arms! Seasons pursuing each other, for the plower ploughs, the mower mows, and the winter grain falls to the ground." Here we have a description of the cycle of life and death, and rebirth, as we know, Whitman likes to highlight. From this scene, Whitman kind of creates a silence, or at least invites the reader to appreciate the silence of the still waters. In the lines where he describes the lakes, the pike fisher, as they watch and wait by the hole in the frozen surface. Whitman then observes a group of flatboatmen, which make fast towards dusk near the cottonwood or pecan trees. In relating this line, I found a painting by George Caleb Bingham, who is considered one of the most important American painters of the genre subjects in the mid-19th century. His series of scenes of life and work on the Missouri and Mississippi rivers established his reputation in his own day and are recognized today as his finest creations. So the Jolly Flatboat Men, a painting of his, depicts a group of men who, after accomplishing the hard work of rowing their flatboat upstream and loading it with cargo, are now relaxing and enjoying music and dancing. Bingham is particularly lauded for his careful attention to detail. There's a raccoon featured in the painting, a raccoon pelt hanging from a nail, a coil of rope, a turkey which sticks its head out below a dancing man, all centered around this beautiful scene of a hill range and still waters. And so this painting was a nice way to bring home, to really to reinforce the image that Whitman himself was trying to describe, not just of the flatboat men, but just of, like I keep on saying, the working man for his time. Next, the speaker talks of the coon seekers who go through the regions of the Red River, or through those drained by the Tennessee, or through those of the Arkansas. I was interested by the word coon seeker. As far as I know, a coon is a pejorative usually given to a black person, but at the same time, it's also a short form for a raccoon. So I think it's easier to go with the latter. The coon seekers are seeking raccoons as they go through the regions of the Red River or the Tennessee or the bodies of water of those of the Arkansas. After naming bodies of water like the Chattahoochee and the Altamahaw, the housing of the Wild West, home to the rest hunters and trappers, they rest amid the walls of adobe in canvas tents. The city sleeps and the country sleeps, all the same. The living sleep for their time, and the dead sleep for their time, for their state of living or death is not permanent. As we know, we are all engaged in this process of living, dying, and rebirth. As Whitman brings his poem, this section, to a close, he depicts the old husband sleeping by his wife and the young husband who sleeps by his wife. These tend inward to him, and he tends outward to them. This is a moment of reflection. It feels like he's telling a grand old story, like an elder detailing their life experiences, thereafter concluding by taking it all in and reflecting towards those he is narrating to. And such as it is to be, of these more or less I am, and of these one and all I weave the song of myself. Once again, it's this interconnectedness, the celebration of everything that Whitman is partaking in. Interestingly, this is the second time where Whitman says the title of his poem, Song of Myself. Or at least, this is the second time that we have highlighted so far.